From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Teresa Rayford is the founder and executive director of Don't Shoot Portland, a Black-led and community-driven nonprofit in Portland, Oregon, that advocates for accountability to create social change in the spaces of human rights and racial justice. Thank you, Teresa, for coming on to the Oregon Grapevine. I appreciate your time here today. And I would like to start with just the mission statement of your organization and ask you, how can and do you create accountability and social change spaces of human rights and racial justice?
Well, basically educating our community on what it means to self-advocate for oneself, participating in civic spaces, testifying in regards to policy, providing your experience to people that have political influence. All of those different things matter. But historically, in our communities, we've been kind of relegated to the appointed leaders or the faith-based community to cry to our causes on our behalf. And with our organization, we bring the people directly to that effort. We believe that leadership matters in communities, but educating and engagement also matter if we don't want to have the ineffective outcomes or the overrepresentation where there should be successes. And what that means to me in the paradigm of social justice in Oregon means, having leaders that can see us through an anti-racist lens that won't perpetrate, problematic bias or discriminative practice against us because we allow it, because we don't know better. Having the information, being informed, being engaged gives us a level of leverage to, be able to assert ourselves. And so that's pretty much what it means is, having that opportunity as people in America, along with everyone else.
So I know that some of the work you do, certainly, and a lot of it is driven by defunding or demilitarizing the police, and those can be charged words. So I'd like you to speak a moment to, and charged perhaps in a good way. I mean, that may in fact be the point. So I'd love you to educate me a bit about those words and maybe the history of the police, where it's coming from, because it can be so charged and stop people from talking with each other.
Right, and usually the people that don't want to hear those things are people that benefit from the policies that harm a lot of people in America. This past week, we all talked about the Derek Chauvin trial and the outcome, and people looked at that outcome as something that was sufficient in changing the paradigm for many people in America in regards to police brutality and state-sanctioned violence. But in the reality of it, that one sentence, that one, a charge or conviction against one officer in the full America doesn't change policy in regards to who's safe in America. It doesn't charge that, public safety for all communities is the same. And what we have to understand is that in our country's history, that the problematic outcomes our policy, the discriminatory practices, the funding, the will to accommodate, calling people marginalized or at risk or disadvantaged because it allocates more resources to kind of primarily, criminalizing them as people in society. Those sanctions against people's presence in space, they're very harmful. They attribute to what we all know in our history of white supremacist attitude and policy. So we have to do something about it. When organizations work to defund the police, our organization supports the educational effort that's needed to bring in communities that have been affected by it. We don't lead the work or the cause because it's very political. It takes a lot of involvement, and a lot of respect from leaders to even be able to be in a participant at a table where they're having these discussions And as a Black-led organization, we've never really been invited to those tables. We've never been looked upon as leaders in aggregate to community engagement. So we have to do our part in educating our community about these conversations that are happening about us and around us and what that means for us as individuals in this country. We're treated as the invisible problem, but in our organization's work, we are building a framework that allows people to be included in these conversations and not just be the subject matter, not to just be the afterthought. And so, again, it's mostly about community engagement through education and thoughtful inclusion.
I'm playing devil's advocate here to kind of to flesh out the work that you're doing. I think some people would say, because the words defund or demilitarize the police are so evocative, they would say, wait a second, aren't there things the police do that are good? If you defund that organization, what happens to solving some other crimes? What happens to traffic issues? What happens to domestic violence cases, etc.?
Well, how many white people are killed in traffic stops on a regular, where we have to ask communities to film them, where there are children actually filming these stops? How many, it's happening to certain demographics in society, and it's happening because of policy that is very aware that we are devaluing them in society, and the practice is accommodated by the authority to do so. It's state-sanctioned violence. Like, my grandsons are biracial, 3 and 4 year olds, but I know that by the time they get in double digits, someone's going to use the word bad kid to describe them, or that kid did this, or, those things are kind of a trigger, because we know what comes next, whether it's in our school systems, whether it's outside in a park, regardless of where it is. We know our country's history around policing and who is policed and who is allowed to be harmed in policing. And I don't have to kind of define what those numbers look like or what those demographics look like, but we all know. And if we're all just comfortable with saying, well, we are killing a couple of little kids and we're killing a lot of Black people and women and children, but we still need to make sure that we have, someone to come and make sure nobody's robbing their house. We don't have homeowners killing people for robbing their houses as much as we have police killing people for, traffic stops or being unarmed or for running from them. And so it's in my own, currency as a human being that I wouldn't want a city employee, murdering my neighbor for any reason. Even if they, robbed my car, I don't think that I can equate the loss of their life with the robbing of the car. And I think that if there is a reason for that person to have to rob a car, break into a house, burn something down or whatever, there is probably an emotional or some kind of human issue that should be addressed. That could probably prevent it if we had those different kinds of values. But we don't have those values when it comes to certain demographics in society. The value is, perpetuating violence against them in order to create order. But we're not investing in what order looks like for someone who needs the accommodation of social access.
And how do we go there? How do we get those social mores and social organizations and social...
We have to stop denying that white supremacy is policy. We have to stop that denying. We have to stop trying to force communities that have been hindered by privilege and by white supremacist policy. We have to stop moving to assimilate them, because that in itself is violent. As a society, the minority and the majority of the people are different power angles, and the people with the power resist treating people without power as humans or as equals. And that's not a position that I get to argue, because I don't have any power in society. We're literally begging for our children's lives. And that's an afterthought for some. And that's also the part of that privilege. I don't have power against white supremacists. I don't have power against white superiority, white privilege, or our agency. The Vice President of the United States just denied that racism, that America is a racist country. I don't have any kind of power at all with any of these motives, but the power that I do have as a community organizer is to suggest and to invest and inform and educate our communities on what it actually means to be a participant in the American system, so that maybe their participation can influence political leaders in the future to kind of dismantle the oppression that exists. And I think that the oppression that exists, it harms all of us, whether we feel that way or not.
I just read an essay which is reminiscent of this by a woman named Ela Biss. And in it she says, she has occasion to wonder whether white supremacists are any more dangerous than regular white people who tend to enjoy supremacy without believing in it, which is part of what you just said. And I wonder how you help me as a senior citizen white woman in this nation really kind of understand and do something.
Yeah, I think that statement makes a lot of sense to me, because if you ignore it, it's just as violent. You know, it's just as vile. You know, I would never watch someone be hurt and try to figure out how to navigate helping them because of the color of their skin. Oh, well, maybe I don't know these people, so I can't help them. That never would occur in my body or in my mind or any part of me. But there are so many millions of people in this country that are like, that's not my problem, that is not my business, I don't have to deal with that. And that's something that they have to deal with. I'm thankful I'm not that person. I'm thankful I don't have that in me. And, you know, I don't have to fight to get rid of it. They do. That is your job as an older white woman or someone in society that benefits and has those choices to benefit. That is the burden that you bear. The rest of us are literally working to survive. We don't have the power to lift ourselves out of that madness. That is, you know, that is a part of the privilege base. Like, we don't have the power, or we would not be here. We're literally on stolen land. I'm from stolen people here. You know, it's like we're captive and we don't have a way out. And I know there's people that say, well, go back to your own country. When you steal someone's body, you abuse them, they're traumatized. This is their own country. We've bled here. You know, we've lost here. We've not stolen anything here.
And I think a lot of people would say Oregon's it's a pretty white state. A lot of organizations are kind of, you look around, certainly I'm in Eugene, certainly you look around and you think, wow, okay, here's more people who kind of look like me, yet I know there's a bunch of people here who don't look like me. How do I find them? What do I do? I think a lot of people just don't have, they think they're fine, and yet they don't really have experience.
I know a lot of people that are from marginalized communities. We've felt that way a lot of our lives. And because of privilege and white supremacy, people have always managed or supervised us or directed us or guided us, even without us asking for it, really. It's just that authority that is there inherently. And I think that we're at a time now where you don't have to look for brown people or people of color to connect with. Maybe do business with them. Maybe support initiatives that provide safety in their communities. Maybe do that from the space that you're in and become an advocate for sharing what that looks like in your local jurisdiction. But I don't think that creating a way to manage to kind of like befriend them or, you know, kind of defend them, I don't think those things really work. They work to do more harm than good, because the trigger for most of us is that is not a sustainable practice, right? I've been a community organizer for years, and I see people that are in their space where they want to do more and they show up to do more, but it's not sustainable because our trauma is not ending. It's not a hobby when you're organizing or doing community advocacy work. It is a struggle to survive, and people that have privilege that haven't had to manage that their entire lives, it's hard to accommodate that long-term commitment. So my thought is just do the work in your own community, because that does a numerous amount for us. I've watched people for years show up to protest, and they organize and they build community within the activist networks, and they're not building that same community outreach in their own neighborhoods, in their own social spaces. And so we continue to accommodate racism. We continue to live without marginalizing it in our daily practice, and that is where we won't get past it. So, I mean, you know, it's good to go to the club and practice it, but we have to practice the sort outside of those spaces in real life and for the rest of our lives if we want the lives of the future generations to be without this conflict.
I would like to turn the conversation. It's still the same place, but a little bit different, because I believe that you specifically and your organization have really done some creative things with art and activism, whether it's spoken word or whether it's other kinds of art. Can you talk for a moment about the importance of art in getting the message across of the work you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of our work, we'll go all the way back 10, 12 years ago, but my nephew used to send me messages all the time about all these kids that he knew in school that were artists, whether they wanted to do hip-hop or dance or they were visual artists. And I used to think, like, wow, that's a lot of value. You know, these children have found who they are. They're building on their purpose. They're using art to communicate. And I know that they're going through a struggle, but they found something that, in my opinion, builds a level of, you know, trauma response, right? You get to take time and meditate with your art. You have that time to kind of connect your soul to meaning and kind of deal with everyday things that might be happening to you. And so I always think about that in my organizing, because my nephew was murdered, and that was one of the reasons that I wanted to start advocating for youth. And I thought if I could bring them resources to build art, to use art, to realize that art is a way to build space for their thoughts and what they're going through, that would help them find more value in their lives so that they could fight for their safety, you know. And that's why you messed Don't Stop, I mean, Don't Shoot Portland. But we called it a community action plan and also a community art project, because we felt like we could build a better society using art to make it beautiful, and using art and building partnerships with the museums and different art schools and different art educators and different spaces that provided art to children and families. And we started advocating for access for families that have been affected by violence. So that while we're advocating for them through the legal system, we could also bring the family into a space where they could, again, self-advocate for their own health and safety, using art as a foundational tool to kind of get where we need it to be and kind of dealing with that, the trauma. And so as the years have gone by, the same institutions that help provide those spaces for us have credentialed us. I think they've given us like credits, like, you know, residencies at the Portland Art Museum with Hank Willis Thomas, being able to fortify our program outreach through those spaces with these huge installations. We did the Upstander Fest in May of 2017 after the murder of the people on the MAX trains, to bring community together to talk about white supremacy, to talk about the different groups that are here in Oregon and how to identify them and keep your neighbors and children safe. Because it was, you know, two young girls on the train that were being protected at the time of those murders by Jeremy Joseph Christian. You know, just using art as a medium to actually have a conversation with community around different issues that are happening in society. And bringing that dialogue into bigger spaces where, again, we can influence policymakers and make social change a direct access point for people who wanted to engage in this type of participation. And art does so much. Art could be, like you said, spoken word, poetry, music. It could be painting. It could be, we've done, what do you call it, wood carving. We've carved out big pictures from our protests that are like 4 foot tall. And this past year, we basically took possession of the Apple Store murals that were created as a memorial in downtown Portland during the George Floyd uprising. And that has kind of pivoted to where we're, you know, working with different artists who also have art out there to kind of help teach them how to not only acquire their art, but how to preserve it and store it. And so for our foundation, we're hoping that by advocating for artists, by creating art, and by buying art and kind of holding on to it, that we create a sustainable foundation for the future, because a lot of the artwork that we do, it does turn into legal service and resources for advocacy. So hopefully our art will help make our work sustainable so that we don't have to become, you know, full-out capitalists.
Thank you so much for that explanation and for talking a bit about what you do. Is there something you'd like to add here about the work you do, or how we all can learn more and do more in this struggle?
Well, we just did a panel with the Schomburg Museum, and it brought together historians, archivists, activists, and preservationists, librarians from all over the nation. And we talked about the importance of documenting information, of documenting history as it's happening, of using different mediums, whether it be social media, video, art, or just our own opinion editorials, some of the work like what you're doing now. To us, this is how people are going to understand these times in history. And I think that the mediums that we use and how we share them, again, that will kind of attract people. And for me, again, art is the biggest medium. If I'm doing research and I see a picture or an image, I'm more likely to do more research in that direction than if I see a lot of footnotes. And so I'm just hoping that people understand how powerful how they feel about what's going on in the world is, whether it's, you know, something that I would agree with or not. Information is essential, and how we bring ourselves together is how we're going to change, how we're going to actually make change or direct those efforts for people that want to know what's next. So I just, you know, like, there's nothing like sharing. Share how you feel. Don't wait to hear from other people or, you know, checking in, because we've gotten to that point now where we won't share how we feel. We won't talk about it until someone else has affirmed it. And that's, to me, it's a mistake, because there's so much inside of us that if we share it, it'll be out, and then we can use it to make things better. So that's all I can think of.
Thank you so much, Teresa, for your time and your insights and for the work you do. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.